Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, what's up? Welcome to the Alternative Facts Podcast, Billboard's weekly podcast for rock, alt-rock, punk, pop-punk, emo, experimental shit, metal. This week, focusing on emo. It's a very emo episode. If you know me, this is not a surprise. My name's Chris Payne. I'm a staff writer at Billboard. I host this podcast every week. And yeah, the big E-word, the emo podcast. This week, it's not a musician, but a fellow podcaster. Double podcast talk coming at you with Tom Mullen. He is a good friend of mine, and he's the leader of a thing called Washed Up Emo, which is not washed up at all. It's actually a very vibrant, very current source of commentary on all things coming from the emo world. And aside from being a podcaster, it's also a DJ night, a couple of websites, awesome Twitter account, but he has his first book coming out, and it's out already, I should say. It's in stores now, online, on Amazon, it's everywhere. Go get it. It's called The Anthology of Emo, Volume 1. And what it is a compilation of a bunch of interviews that he's done with emo superstars over the years. People like Dashboard Confessional, The Get Up Kids, The Promise Ring. He's interviewed like Jimmy Eat World, even though they're not in this book, because he probably has a future one coming. But he's done a ton of interviews with all sorts of people across the scene, and it was a lot of fun talking to Tom about the backstory behind these, about how it actually went down, little anecdotes, what it's like to talk to these people, what it's like being involved in the scene, going to shows for so many years. I invited him into the Billboard office a couple weeks back, and you're about to hear this conversation. A lot of nerding out between two people who just really, really care about this stuff. And I hope you do too. And I hope this is an inspiring talk for you guys. Like I said, this book that he did just completely came out of a podcast that he started on his own about 10 years ago. So if you guys are into writing books or starting podcasts, doing interviews, things like that, hopefully some words of wisdom passed on to you guys. And this was a blast for me to have this talk, you know. I got into this scene of music around 2002, 2003, thereabouts, and it really was what just got me into music journalism or into the media world in general, you know, reading alternative press, absolutepunk.net, things like that. It's what just got me writing on my own, doing interviews, doing reviews, going out to shows. It was a big thing for me. And Tom also, I think it had a very similar impact on him. And he comes from a slightly different perspective. He's a few years older than me, got into the scene a few years prior. So we have kind of differing points of view on some things. Like when he was getting into things, the scene wasn't as blowing up in the mainstream as it was when I got into it in the mid-2000s. So we kind of have some different perspectives here on things, but I think that's what makes for a really good conversation. And yeah, so I'm not going to ramble anymore. This is already an episode on the longer side, but I had a blast with this, and I hope you do too. So here it is. Here is my talk with Tom Mullen of Washed Up Emo.
Forgive me for running off to find the one thing I have to do.
Tom Mullen?
Yes.
Washed Up Emo. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, you're a repeat guest on the podcast world of Billboard now.
Yes. The first one was really fun.
Yeah, I had a blast. And you've got a lot more going on now. You're expanding into different mediums.
I'm trying. I'm trying something physical this time.
Yeah. So you have your first book coming out very shortly, but before we dive into all that, why don't you give the listeners a little primer on what Washed Up Emo is, how it started, how it began as a podcast, as a DJ night, as a web presence, maybe as a lifestyle, and now how it's becoming this book.
Yeah, so the site started 10 years ago in October 2007. So last month was 10 years, and I started because the bands I loved weren't online. I know that sounds crazy today, but there actually wasn't any articles about American football. There weren't any things about Elliot or any of these bands that I thought should be mentioned. So I was like, let me just make a website. Made a crappy website, started talking about them, and then throughout the years sort of helped smaller bands that maybe were sounding like those bands. So that was the first few years, just talking about the old bands, reminding people about new stuff. And then in 2011, started the podcast where I was like, wait, there's no oral history. No one's heard Mike Kinsella's voice. There's a AP, maybe Alt Press maybe did something, but it was written, not audio. No one's told these stories. Let me do that. So that snowballed. So now that's going on 6 years. And then a few months before that, the DJ night started, where we realized that we had all these friends that liked playing music. So on Valentine's Day 2011, we started a DJ night playing records from all eras, from the 80s, 90s through today, which was really fun. We had so many people guest over the years. If it's Chris Conley, Max Bemis, Armor for Sleep Guys, Christy Front Drive, like just Braid. Like, it's kind of cool over the years. Now those people get paid. We didn't pay them. We just gave them free beer and fun. But it was cool. It's been interesting to see that take off, but it's still fun. We're still doing it consistently every month. We've been doing it every month now since 2011, which is kind of crazy. So then I go, wait a minute. 2 years ago, I went, there could be a really cool way to showcase these interviews in another way, in written form. People would want to own it. And so about 2 years ago, I realized that my cousin worked for Interview Magazine, and he was moving to New York, and I knew that I could pay him to transcribe. So I said, why don't you transcribe these? I think there could be a book opportunity. We started doing that, and then a friend wrote me who designed books and said, hey, if you ever do a book, I'll help you design it. And so that's kind of where it came from.
It's like your 10-year anniversary tour.
It is.
The classics.
It's kind of crazy. 10 years of doing it. I mean, and then starting to go to shows 23 years ago, 25 years ago, which is kind of nuts to think about, too.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of those shows, those memories are embedded in these interviews. So to give the people a primer, 10 interviews, right, in the book?
Yes.
10 greatest hits, so to speak, from across the library, the very deep library of over
100-plus episodes.
Yeah, 100-plus episodes of the Washed Up Emo podcast, which you can listen to, download, subscribe to after you're done listening to this podcast. Jump in. So you picked out some of the all-stars, your Chris Carrabba's and your Matt Pryor's and your Davey Von Bolen's that you had in this interview series, and you took those podcasts and you made them into print form, hardcover, leather-bound.
It's a soft
cover leather.
It looks academic.
It looks very academic.
That was the goal. Like, it wasn't supposed to. This is not a joke. This is serious. Here is the actual words, not masked by a star tattoo or anything like that. And this is it, serious, from all those eras. And I think the volume one has a pretty good smattering of, if you're into one genre, you might read about somebody else, or you might like just the old stuff, but maybe Chris says something cool. So, and I'm already doing volume, I'm already working on volume two.
Okay, so I was going to ask you about that, because there were some big interviews, the Jimmy World guys,
his
Jawbreaker interview, Saves the Day, who didn't make the first book.
Yeah, which is, I loved one of the reviews that came out early on. They were like, we'll see if he can come back with a volume two. I was like, are you kidding? I didn't even bring out, some of the hits. So it was funny to hear that. But yeah, I think there's an interview that I did with Jim Atkins and Eric Richter from Christy Front Drive. Christy Front Drive is an important band that got a lot of bands signed. They were really integral.
They made Capitol realize Jimmy World was...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, Eric's a huge... So basically, that interview is in a hotel room. Eric just busting on Jim Atkins. And it's hilarious because they both know each other really well. So it was like, I didn't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. I just sat there with a mic and watched them spar. So that's a fun one that'll be fun to get out there when that does.
What are some of the, for you personally, what are some of your favorite interview moments that are in this book?
I would say we did a live episode with, which it was really nervous to have to do something like actually people are going to show up and pay like $5 to listen to me, like whatever. I didn't think people would, but we did one where Norman from Texas Reason wrote me and said, hey, Steve from Thursday has come out to his friends and family, but not publicly. We want to do a space where he were able to do that. And we're kind of forcing him. And so Jason, not forcing, but he agreed, but it was, this was his like, all right, we're doing it on this date. Mm. So Jason from The Promise Ring came, Norm and Steve. And the what the funny part of the interview is, I always remember this, is I had my computer and my notes of like what I was going to ask. Mm. And there was a question right before I was about to bring that up about basically Steve talking about coming out. Mm. And which is, I don't know that feeling because I am not gay, but I have a feeling that that is not, that is a hard decision to make, and it's something that's very serious. So he saw my next question, and he told me after that he stalled and kept talking because he was so nervous. But after, when he finished, he said, thank you. That was something I needed to do. And for me to be like, I had some random thing I came up with 10 years ago that he was able to do something really personal, that moment to me meant a lot. So that's probably a big moment. And then also John Bunch from Sensefield, I did his last interview before he passed, a few months before he, killed himself. Basically, I did his last interview. Yeah. So I had to re-edit it, actually. I had it done, ready to post. Mm. And the end of it was, see you in LA.
Yeah.
And I had to edit it. So that was kind of crazy. So, you know, those are two serious things, but I think those are kind of things I didn't plan for, but they happen. And I think it meant a lot.
Were there any interviews, especially ones in the book that the people can read now, that you were just kind of nervous for? Maybe bands that you were just like very closely tied to, looked up to when you were younger, that you kind of just like, it's tough to just take on that stoic interviewer role in doing the podcast.
Yeah. I think early on, because I'd been doing interviews from college radio and newspaper stuff, and I'd been kind of doing it, so I felt comfortable with them and I knew enough. A great early review, I believe it was David Anthony in AV Club. He kind of said, I'm gonna paraphrase it horribly, but it was like, he's a super nerd, but he kind of holds it back and he knows you're going to ask your question. I think that's how I come across. Like, they know I'm a super nerd, but I'm not punishing. I think that's the balance.
Yeah.
So, but I will say the Promise Ring one, which was an early one, and I had some crappy USB headset that I used to use. Now I use a nice microphone, but I was using a crappy headset. It went out. So I'm on the phone with Dan and Davey from the Promise Ring for the first time I'm speaking to them ever. They know who I am kind of tangentially through label stuff that I'd been with, labels. Mm-hmm. But all I remember is my USB mic goes out, and all I hear is Davey and Dan going, Tom? Tom, are you there? Tom. And I'm screaming, yes, I'm here. And they can't hear me because my mic went out and I had to call them back. It was really funny. But I actually saved that little clip of them kind of being like, well, I guess we'll go, Dan, right? Yeah, Davey. All right, I'll talk to you later. Like, and it's like my heroes and like they can't hear me. So maybe that's my nightmare.
Well, that's you lead the book with that interview. And I guess you just kind of like conveniently edited that little bit out.
I totally did. No one heard that when it was released anyway. I took that out, obviously. But they ended up doing the interview. They finished it a few months later when we reconnected. But I always remember that being like super nervous of like, oh my God, they're not going to call me back. Like, I'm such an idiot. I'm so budget. So I stepped it up on the mic after that.
What about all the visuals in the book? One thing that the podcast really can't bring. So tell me about these gig posters and old black and white photos from shows.
Yeah.
How did these come about?
That was me bugging them. That was me bugging all the bands. What do you have in your basement? And a lot of these guys have never thought about that. So it was me bugging them, and friends that have followed me on Instagram, or I reached out to a few folks. This guy, Chris Bariner, who was in Ethel Meserve, which a lot of people maybe don't know. They're from Pennsylvania. They did a ton of shows. He saved everything. Mm. So he's posting right now a show from today back in 99 or 2000 or 98. Like, it's crazy. So I asked him, I was like, hey, do you have anything on the Van Pelt? Do you have anything for these bands? And he just had a ton of stuff. So reaching out to people, that I knew had stuff. And then also Michael Dubin, who took a lot of photos in Long Island, New Jersey, in the, you know, the heyday. He also, he had a Matt Pryor photo that he hadn't used that he let me use for the Pryor. So depends. The band sometimes had stuff and sometimes it was outside.
I love how the punk world was one place where, as we moved on to modern photographic technology, as late as maybe like 2000, every picture is in black and white.
Yeah. Yeah. That was like the way to be cool. Yeah, that's, I mean, I remember developing, when I took a photo class in college with my crappy camera, I shot on black and white.
Yeah. Every gig poster looks like it was like photocopied together 15 years earlier.
Yeah. That was definitely the aesthetic. So, but it was really cool. I think that brings it, you know, the set list, the photos, the different pieces help tell the story.
Sure. Yeah, let's drop in some music. What is, I don't know, what do you think would be a good song to drop in for the people, maybe to acclimate them to what this
book is all about? We did a playlist for this.
Okay.
So, the Anthology of Emo, you can find it on the Washed Up Emo profile on Spotify, and Tidal. It's also on Tidal. I'm trying to think. I would say Promise Ring's a good one just because of all the bands. I put, you know, a Promise Ring song, a Maritime song, and a Vermont song. And I think it was important to list out all the bands.
Sure.
Because a lot of people maybe only...
Get all those Kinsella bands in there.
That was crazy. The Kinsella one, which I'm not even going to be able to recite. Maybe you can. No. But all of them, I thought, how hilarious would that be to just put Kinsella's name and have every band he was in, so... I'm sure some nerd will say that there's I missed something. So
give me a Promise Ring song.
I would say Why Did We Ever Meet?
Promise Ring interview towards the end is one where you nerd out a little bit and they're putting together their set lists for their reunion shows. And they're like, we haven't played together in years. We only have like 2 afternoons to rehearse. We're not going to have a ton of songs to pick from. We're trying to learn like 20 songs. And you're naming like
the most obscure
Sea of Cortez, like an instrumental track from their first album.
I was laughing at editing that because you can tell Davies get so frustrated and like annoyed. And I just love that because he was just like, are you seriously asking about... what was it? Wasn't it the dinner interlude song? There's like an interlude where it's just like people talking.
That's an intro to one of the songs. That's an intro.
The intro. So I said, could you play that intro before that song? And he was just like, that's enough. Like, you're crazy. I was like, I know. Can you do it?
I remember I interviewed Jimmy World for a Billboard podcast, and they're my all-time favorite band. They're why I do this. And I was
can
like,
we do a Jimmy
nervous.
World podcast? Because that's my favorite.
Let's do a Jimmy World podcast. we were chatting early, and I just was very excited, and we did like your Promise Ring discussion. We were talking about like what song off Static Prevails they would still put in a set list. You know, totally normal thing for the first 5 minutes of a Jimmy Eat World interview, and one of them joked like, yeah, we could play, you know, Rockstar, maybe we'll just play like, you know, track 7 off Static Prevails. And I was like, without checking myself, I was like, oh like Caveman. And I was like, and they're like, yo, what? And they're like, what? And I was like, yeah, I don't really know the set list. That's like around track 7. And then I looked later and it was track 7.
Of course it was. I mean, did you know the petition I started for the Clarity tour?
For the Clarity 10-year anniversary tour?
Do you know the petition I started?
I was there, but tell me about the petition.
So they played Goodbye Sky Harbor previously to that as a 6-minute song. So when they announced the tour, I said, well, you better play the 16-minute version. And so this was when live streaming, like chat, was kind of pretty basic. And I remember they had one where a chat kind of scrolled, so you had to get their attention. It wasn't like they were picking from Twitter or picking from Facebook. So I kept writing, play the full 16 minutes, play the full 16 minutes. And I remember Zach like cracking a joke being like, enough. But I started a petition and it got like hundreds of signatures of people being like, you should play the full version. And I found out later that it had a part in them playing the longer version during the Clarity tour, which I felt pretty proud about, because I don't want to hear that 6 minute jam. It's great. I love when you do it during the set. But if that's that clarity tour, play the 16 minutes.
Yeah, man, I was in college. I remember coming, because I went to college in TCNJ closer to South Jersey, but I remember coming up to New York for Terminal 5 for that one.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
Just kidding. I'm sure they realized that at the end. But I thought it was cool that they tried it. They tried to do the crazy version.
For sure.
Especially for that tour.
Yeah. Let's drop in a little bit of seriously. Goodbye Sky Harbor. So let's talk about some of the basics of Watchtip Emo and the criteria for becoming the sort of band that you could interview for the podcast and thus making it into one of the books. How do you decide who qualifies as an emo band and who doesn't?
What do you mean? I don't decide that. It's all about good music and also connections and understanding of history. I think there's eras to every one of those genres. And like our DJ night, we play everything. So if someone comes up and says, I want to hear Starting Line, course. If you want to hear Foxing, awesome. Or if you want to hear Rites of Spring, all of those fit. And I think there's connections to all of them. It's when it's a copy of a copy of a copy, when it's derivative, when it's forced. Those things are where it starts to deviate for me. And I think when a band understands the history, and not saying you have to reference Jimmy Eat World or you have to reference Rites of Spring, but you understand there's a history and a length to the genre itself, and you're not just attaching yourself to it for gain. That's when it sort of loses it for me.
So the second book will have the Linkin Park interview.
So Linkin Park was one of the first bands I worked when I moved to New York City, and I saw their first show in Philadelphia on the East Coast, and they opened up for Union Underground. No one gave a crap. It was crazy. They were playing the first record. They were playing Hybrid Theory.
Oh, my
Theory.
God. Yeah, what it must have been like. I love that record. Like, what it must have been like to see Hybrid Theory perform in a little club.
When I got the promo from Warner Brothers, they hadn't changed their name to Linkin Park yet. They were still called Hybrid Theory. And I remember hearing it being like, this has 5 singles. This is crazy. And for them to, you know, have the longevity and the career that they put forth was pretty nuts. But it's fun. That's what I loved. And it goes back to seeing these early bands at an early point. It's great to see them when they're new and you can help them. And then they are like a modern baseball. You know, those guys DJed with us. Hotelier DJed with us really early on. And now they're getting crazy offers, or Modern Baseball had, you know, a great success. And a lot of people following them. Like, it's awesome to see that for those bands. And it's all, I didn't mention earlier, it's about the community. If you understand that there's a community and you're part of it, like, I would always get bands to hit me up, be like, I can't get shows. Like, are you friends with any bands in your town? Like, play a show with them. Doesn't matter if they're metal, hardcore, punk, indie. Doesn't have to sound like your band. Play with them. Meet new people. Travel together. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes that gets lost when you're just thinking about, well, I got to sound like this and I got to do this. This is what's hot. It's not going to be authentic. So that's the other piece, the community and authenticity. I think that's what I can see that really easily.
Sure. And it's a lot, it goes far beyond sound. It's where your roots are, where you come up from, what sort of beliefs you ascribe to, things like that.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that I love a lot of the bands that might not be associated, or I've been told that, you know, you're drawing these lines in the sand. The site that I came up with is thisbandemo.com. As I've said multiple times, it's a joke and serious at the same time. Like, a girl wrote this morning saying, why is this band not? I was like, if you think they are awesome, go listen to them. I like them. I just made a snarky comment. Like, that's it.
What band was it?
I don't even remember. I forget. It was like an indie rock band, like a total, like, you know, indie pop. But if you think it is and you connect to it and you're connecting to that song and that band, then it is to you. So that it's kind of like some people take it too seriously. I know Reddit, like, they hate the site, which some of the subreddits for emo.
The emo,
like,
subreddit?
Yeah, they like hate it, which I've gone on multiple times being like, it's just a joke. Like... It's literally just a joke. I came up with it in like an afternoon and spent 2 weeks importing and had friends help, and that's it. That's literally all the site.
So it's in making the winkingly serious, not serious decisions for this, you have a panel of people, right, who help you out?
I totally do. Yeah, there's people all over the world that from bands, writers, people in the scene, band, all those folks that we just kind of like, I'll bug them about stuff and say, hey, what do you think? Or have you heard this band? And we're having a regular dialogue about new bands anyway. That's the best part.
Add them to the archive.
Yeah, like, here's this band. Have you heard them? No. Oh, my God. Wow, that's really cool. Or this band put out 1/7 inch in 97 on this label. Do you remember them? No. Send me the track. Oh, that's really... It's this... There's bands and there's things to discover in the past and today, which excites me. And I think my one gripe with that mid-2000s era is that that's it and that's all there was. And it's okay. I love so many of those bands. I worked a ton of them when I was at EVR and Vagrant. I know, but know the whole time period and go with it. Like, follow them past that heyday. Follow them to that next record. Follow them to that next band, that solo album. You know, if Fred or somebody and, you know, John Nolan or Taking Back Sunday, if those guys have solo records, follow them that way. Support. And I think sometimes that got lost.
Shout out to The Color Fred.
Oh, yeah. One of his records we did at EVR was like 90% recyclable. Like the tray, the case, the paper. It was like really big deal for him. So we like spent all this money to do like this crazy recyclable case, CD case.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role. Like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, so with that mid-2000s era you mentioned where there were a lot of Fairweather fans, I think what does make it tricky, and I can speak firsthand because I got into the scene in 2003... and it was nearing or at its commercial peak when I was like at my peak interest in it when I was like 16, 17 years old. And because it was so close to the mainstream and because a bunch of the bands were really a part of the mainstream for that moment, you just naturally bring on a lot of just general pop fans who aren't necessarily embedded in a scene where it's like if you're just like a teenager in high school aware of music, you would maybe really be into to Taking Back Sunday or Dashboard Confessional or My Chemical Romance or Fall Out Boy. You at least know who they are. So then you just have sort of a lot of people who just think of emo as like, well, I guess it was only around between like my high school years because I don't hear about it anymore. Yeah. I never heard about it before that, so I guess that was it.
Yeah. It's just troubling because I think there's like this education part that I talked about earlier, like when there was the Where's the Band tour. Was it Pryor and Conley and Dan Andriano from Alkaline Trio? And people were talking during acoustic songs if it wasn't Matt or Chris doing a hit. And the Bell House show was pretty awkward where it was like, we're like trying to play a song and it's just like literally audible conversation. And I think that, like, I'm happy they came. I'm happy whoever was there. But there's this sort of like... I don't know. I don't know this Dan Andriano song, but he's in Alkaline Trio. I'm going to shut up for a second. Like, I don't think that...
It brought out people who don't get that etiquette about shows. And, you know, some of that might not exactly be their fault.
No.
But they probably just haven't been out to a lot of, like, the shows that, you know, this community that we're talking about.
But I think the bands didn't realize that. I don't think the bands realized that large group of people that came on board while you were there and you're still there, there was a larger group that I thought didn't go with them. And I think they realized, they thought that was going to happen. You know, watching a band and have them only care about four or five songs, like that's tough for a band. And maybe that happens over time, that it slowly gets there. But I'm not saying I listen to the new Taking Back Sunday as much as I do the older stuff. But I did before the show, and I wanted to hear, and they wanted to play the whole record. But I think it's I don't think the bands realize that, because they're like, oh, wow, we sold it out. Well, it's tough. So I think they're grappling with that, along with the fan base being like, well, I want that. I know you have a new thing. It's tough. Maybe they're not used to it.
Yeah, it must be really kind of a trip if you're in one of those bands that did have that brief window of commercial success, where you're going to have this subset, maybe majority of people coming out to your show who only really want to hear three or four songs and don't even really know about the rest. You know, someone who was just into like Saves the Day for At Your Funeral, or someone who was into Chris Carrabba for
a minute,
for like a Mission Brand of Scar, like the album before that, who just wants to hear those hits. Yeah. And
maybe that's for every band. It's interesting for that time period because it got so huge.
But like a Promise Ring show now, they probably wouldn't have to deal with anything like that.
No.
A Get Up Kids show, not really, you know.
There's an interesting audible with what songs based on the time. I've noticed that DJing. So early on, I would play these Get Up Kids songs, and I would notice as the years passed, it's slowly creeping, less people requesting 4 Minute Mile, more people Something to Write Home About. But it happened over, like, it's funny to kind of, you can see the requests. Like, someone came up and said, I want some old Coheed. I was like, awesome. What are you feeling, Second Stage? And they were like, there was a record from like 08.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh. But it was cool. Like, that's, but it was fine. We still played it. Like, it made sense. But I think the age of people, you know, going with the band, sometimes that lessens. And I think a band, you said, they're not used to that maybe, or they didn't realize it. I'm not in their shoes, but thank God they still showed up. They paid the ticket. They're still going to hear the songs. There are people there. But I think it's interesting to watch the reaction.
Yeah, and you could do like a whole like adolescent psychology study on this. But I think whatever you're really into when you're like 15, 16, 17, regardless of how much you're into whatever music after that, your mind is just in a unique place where whatever you're into in those peak teenage years just imprints on you in such a deep emotional way that it's like nothing can ever top that. And you're always going to have the strongest connection when you hear those songs live to anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's so strong. Yeah.
For you, what are those songs? Like, what would bring that out in you?
We can bring it up. I mean, Jimmy Eat World Clarity, that was huge. Bleed American, seeing that break was really fun. What else? Appleseed Cast, Jealous Sound. But then being able to be a part of Circa Survive and that record breaking.
Yeah, that would have been when you were working, right?
I was working. Yeah. So like those moments are also like, I'm seeing them tonight. And
the show with Thrice.
Yeah. So Colin's doing the podcast, you know, but like those moments, like, you know, being able to help a band that way. And, you know, that meant a lot too. So I had kind of the teenage, like, oh my God, these bands are huge to me. And now I'm talking to them and now I'm able to help.
Yeah.
Those are kind of, I guess, unique, but I don't take it for granted. Like, I think about that stuff a lot where I'm here to help them. That was my only key. When I would go up to bands and get radio IDs, that's how I would get to meet them. I would just say, hey, I don't need an interview at the show. I just need to go up to them and get a radio ID for the college radio station. And that's how I met Jimmy Eat World for the first time. That's how I met Newfound Glory. Like, all these bands, they just knew we were getting IDs. And we have a ton of outtakes of these bands trying to read my handwriting, because I have horrible handwriting, and I would hand them a card to read, and they, like Tom from Promise, or Tom from Jimmy Eat World, actually, there's a hilarious one where he can't read it. It's really funny. So, but like those moments, like, again, those are special times where it helps connect.
Sure. You mentioned one of my favorites too from that era, a little bit before me, but Jealous Sound in the book. That's one of the, I think, one of the more low key interviews that hopefully gets some more people into them, because that they have a couple albums, but the one album they did in the early 2000s, their debut, Kill Them With Kindness, is just such an underappreciated masterpiece of those times.
Yeah, Blair Sheehan, I think lyrically, I don't pay attention to lyrics a lot, I will admit. That's the last thing I listen to. I'm a guitar player, so I listen to the riff. I listen to the, like, I want to feel like I can play it. The lyrics are kind of last for me. It kind of, like, he somehow connects with me early with the lyrics, and I think he's special in that, and his riffs and the way that he palm mutes and those things. And his band Racket Club right now, which
they
he's
put
doing,
out an album, yeah.
Yeah, with Serge from Sam I Am. Like, great record. Like, it's just, again, like, he's like a, I think he's like this unheralded, like, very special person in the scene that, you know, should have had more love, but hopefully at some point people realize when they read this interview, like, there's deeper things with him. And also, you know, he was in Knapsack too. He did Knapsack, which a lot of people have a lot of reverence for.
Let's drop in Hope For Us.
Oh, great job.
Yeah, this is one of the songs you do nerd out a little bit on the podcast and the book. So this is the should have been hit single from this Jealous Sound album we keep talking about. This is Hope For Us. Oh, yeah. So we were talking about how they kind of just missed. Very frustratingly, they did have, for a hot second, a major label deal with, I believe, Jive.
Mojo?
Mojo? One of those four-letter, cheesy... one of those titles. And then it was this case of the week after they got signed, another label absorbed it, and the one A&R who was really into them, who brought them in, lost their job, and then they were just sort of this lost band, and they were in purgatory for a while, and then finally an indie imprint put out their album. But from talking to him and from reading that interview, it seems like he's not exactly super frustrated about that these days.
Yeah, I got that too. I think it was right for the right reasons. Like, what would have happened? There's such a small percentage that bands, you know, get that shot. Like, what would have happened? Like, could it have led to other things? Great, but it wouldn't have led to this. So,
sure.
I think he's at peace with it.
Yeah, and I would think most, if not all, of the musicians that you talk to in this book would kind of have that attitude. Because if you come up in one of these scenes, in one of these communities, you're not getting into it to just, like, have hit songs and make tons of money in that kind of a music career. So if you, like, have a near miss with a major label, like, you're not going to be like, my life is ending. You're not going to feel like the world is crashing down around you. You're just going to, you know, you're going to be prepared for that.
Well, it's like those bands that I would see, and they'd have their crate amps and their awesome guitars and their, like, perfect thing. And I'm like, no one knows who this band is. How do you, like, it's almost like they tried, like, I'd see them on Warped Tour. You're like, trying too hard. Like, you're right about the bands that I think from that era, like, came up because they had to make this music, they had to do this, they wanted to be a part of someone, part of a community, and I think it shows. And for them to, you know, maybe they had a swing, maybe they had a miss, but they all kind of just wanted to do it.
Yes. Similarly, I'm interested, when you reach out to bands, are there any that see the title Washed Up Emo and they're like, no, I can't do this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a bunch of people that have said no because of it. And until they have a mutual friend say, hey, this is cool.
Sure.
Like, Jeff Farina from Karate was a big one that I, you know, had to go through a friend, like a friend of a friend, to ask him and say, no, he's cool. Like, look at all the other bands. Like,
sure.
It took 2 years to get Brett from the Juliana Theory to do it. Who else have I been asking? Chris Higdon from Elliot. He knows that he wants to do it, but he still hasn't said yes. Like, it's been about 3 years. So I don't give up. Like, there's actually one person I'm really close on that I've been waiting for years and years to say yes, and we're almost there.
Interesting.
So I'm really patient. Basically, it's if you want to tell your story and you look at the list, I'm not outing anybody. I'm not like ahas. I'm not asking any crazy You tell your story, and the best thing about this is there's 100+ episodes. If you go back to the first one, it sounds as evergreen as the one I just released. Like, they're not topical. Like, some will have little instances about what's happening, but most of the time it's, what's your life story? And if you happen to get into the Promise Ring tomorrow or the Jealous Sound, you can listen to Blair tell his story, and you've gotten a little more education and you learn more about them. So that's kind of the apex of it, which I think hopefully comes through with why I thought it was it's not a history book. I had all these people online being like, where's the Rites of Spring interview? It's not a history book. It's volume one. Like, it's just I think people will get it when they see it and they understand, like, here are 10 stories. Here's volume two. We'll have more, another 10 stories. And hopefully you take something from it.
Yeah. Scrolling through your archive of all the podcasts you've done, there really aren't that many major bands you haven't at least gotten a member from.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a few that I've still got on my list. I have this giant list of to schedule, and I have a giant list of to edit. But I think there's a few that I think. I mean, there's one that I'm super nervous about. You brought up about, like, a nervous one. I have a way to get Ian from Fugazi and Minor Threat I could email one person, and I could probably set it up. I'm way too nervous. Because I'm also straight edge, like all those kind of things, his ethos, the way he's presented himself, I sort of have modeled a lot of what I've done. So I'd have a hard time. So that's probably the one where I'm like, I don't know.
Although he
does anything.
He would seem like he's so chatting with any kid who just approached him and wants to talk to him.
Yeah. Or walked up on his porch in DC. He'd probably go and hang and talk with him. Yeah. But for me inside, I'm super nervous just because of the impact he had. But I think there's a few people that I think, especially from the mid-2000s, there's more that I want to get from that era that I think they're... Like Kenny from The Starting Line, I didn't realize a lot of the stuff about him and what shows he went to and how he got... I didn't know any of that. It was really enlightening to hear, and I think there's more of those that could be told.
Sure.
That someone like me would learn. Like, that's the other part about it. I'm not just, like, trying my agenda for these bands. Like, Kenny, I learned a lot from that one. I learned a lot from Tucker from Thursday. Like, I want to know that. Or even when I was interviewing the kid, Jake from Modern Baseball, who's got Slaughter Beach Dog.
Yeah.
Like, I learned a lot about him and what he listened to when he came up and why. And I just interviewed Matt from Everyone Everywhere, who's also the band called The Hurry. I just interviewed him. We were on the phone for 2.5 hours because I was like, tell me more. Like, what was 09 Philly like?
Yeah.
Like, tell me.
That's kids. I mean, I would feel a little bit old talking to someone who was, like, in high school in 2009, you know?
But, like, tell me what was going on. Like, I was amped. Like, what was happening?
Like, I don't know. Because I was an adult. I don't know.
Yeah. So I'm still excited. Like, it's still rad to hear. Like, when you'll hit me up on, Twitter. You'll be like, dude, check out this band. I can't wait to listen to it. Because I still get that excitement. And I think hopefully someone hears that about an older band or a newer band or someone from these podcasts or this book. Like, I hope that happens.
Sure. Yeah, because we were saying you have hit on most of, the greats. The 90s, maybe the late 80s class. But as far as, like, the mid-aughts, and now you're going to have all these, like, emo revival bands in a couple years who are, coming around, have more of a life story to tell, have more life experience, and probably in a couple years that's going to be a lot of what you're having on the podcast.
Yeah, and I think mental health was brought up, too.
Sure.
The guy from Somos brought it up. The dude from Free Throw brought it up. Connor from Foxing brought it up. Connor's is one that if anyone starts with, like, a new band they didn't know, like, that's a good one to start with just because of how honest he was. It's great when someone's like that.
Sure.
They're not guarded. He'd kind of just, like, let loose. But mental health, I think the bands, like, that wasn't happening. That wasn't being talked about. So for them to be really upfront about it was great.
Yeah, that is interesting. Because another one, Pup, who we had on the show there, they've given some very good, frank, open interviews about their mental health and being on the road. It's like you would have thought in the older bands they would have been more open with that. But, also I wasn't really there reading interviews as much in those years, but it seems like it's become much more prominent now.
There might have been. Maybe I missed a zine or here or there, but I think you were paying attention as best you could.
I was, like, reading alternative press and, like, APNet in, like, 2004. Like, I didn't really hear a lot of
Punk
people
news.
Talking. Yeah, I didn't hear people talking that openly about, like, mental health and anxiety and depression and, like, how to get through it and stuff like that.
But to have, the guy from Somos be like, this is what's going on. This is how I helped myself. Like, that's really, like, I hope someone hears that and is like, okay, I can talk to my mom or I can talk to my guidance counselor or whatever it is about something like that and not just kind of push it away.
Sure.
Because that's a big part about emo that I think is appropriated to it. The cutting, the, you know, the suicide, those are not things that I ever thought the word meant. And so those were sort of appropriated throughout the media.
And they're mocking it a lot of times when they put that stuff on. They're not like lending like a helpful.
No, it's a joke.
Yeah.
Which I get really, you know, offended by, because that's not what this is about. This is not, that music is positive. It's not I'm not sad. I'm not like, it's definitely tough to hear those things still. Like there's still those snide comments. And I think that's why the book was academic. Like I'm trying to be as serious as possible.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, like,
is there a more hated word
in
music? Everyone hates the word.
But then again, when you, nowadays, so many things that are not rock bands are just described as emo. I mean, it can be like rappers and Drake and rappers that Drake has discovered or who are on his label. And it can just be like a sweater you call emo. It can be a TV. It can be like anything.
But it seems like it's like there's this negative connotation to that.
I think it's kind of like a oddly cool thing now. But I don't think like emo as like rock music has gotten that much cooler in perception, but I think as the word emo just gets like mainstreamized and just more of like a part of like the teen lexicon, like, oh, you're being so emo, or
yeah,
like, oh, like it's just more of just a mainstream thing and there's less of a stigma if you just call like, oh, that rap song is so emo.
So you see it as not as negative, more of like people are, maybe they understand the word more if they hear it more.
Yeah, maybe, but I also think it has much less specific meaning now. It just basically means someone who's very emotional or something that's very emotional and deep or whatever, you know?
Interesting. I hate when it's just appropriated like that.
Sure.
Like, why, I mean, so there's an emo ska band coming? Like, is that what's happening? Like,
I don't know about that one, but...
But it's like the... It's interesting that word is appropriated when they want something, but then as soon as it's not, it's like shunned. It's just this word, you only want it when it helps you.
Sure.
You don't want it in 2007 when I was starting the site
and
no one cared.
Yeah.
Not no one, but very few.
And still, I think most rock bands now don't want the word emo in their press release.
So the revival, perfect example. There's labels that, hey, we want your help on this band early on. First record, great, I'll do a review. I'll talk about them. Next record comes out, indie rock stalwarts, blah, blah, blah. And they don't want review. They don't want me to write about it. It's interesting. So you want it when you need the help. Not me, I'm saying the word.
Yeah.
But then when you're out of it, you don't want it anymore? Pick. You got to pick.
I do think some of those walls are coming down now, though, because I think just the indie rock, quote, that culture and like those qualifiers, that association, it's nowhere near as cool as it used to be in like the OC days. It's nowhere near as cool in 2017, I think. The word, the emo qualifier is gaining on it a lot. And I think like as you start to see like Pitchfork starting to cough up those best new musics for bands and Coachella starting to put emo bands maybe on one of the side stages, we're slowly starting to see those last few gatekeepers open up to it.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I'm not as negative about it, but just that it just seems like it's always got a little tinge to it.
Sure. But I think if you talk to like a 16-year-old about like, what do you think of emo? I'm sure they've heard it and I'm sure like they've at least used it once or twice, like talking with their friends, and they might have a radically different idea of what it means than we do. I can just guess.
Yeah. That's why it's great talking to the younger bands, because you're able to kind of get those connotations or when they heard it. It's always great to hear when they first heard it.
Yeah.
Was it at a show? Was it a band? Was it a review? Was it my dumb podcast? Like where was it?
Yeah. And you were saying on one of the shows that usually they don't really know where they first heard it.
Yeah, they don't. It's like, oh, someone sent me a record and I overheard it. Or it was another CD that someone gave me, and I read a review, and it said, like, it's interesting. But I don't think there's a more, like, there's probably a more polarizing word that we're not thinking of, but that it just seems like the word's wanted when it's needed, and then when it's not, it's, like, pushed away as if, well, I don't need that anymore, and I'm not going to associate with it. But then when it's cool again, you want it again.
Well.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
What's great about it is that the word is still around. Like, it's not like the genre hasn't morphed. Like, how great is that? It's still alive. Like,
totally.
It's living, and we're talking about it today, and there's bands that reference it but might not, and it's morphing. There's other genres that are attaching to it. So that, to me, says there was something to it. There's something to it that's deeper than what people think.
For sure. And, like, even if it's not always being used to describe rock bands anymore, I think the use of the word just in culture at large is even more pervasive than what it was like 5-10 years ago. So
you're right.
Regardless of what it's describing, the word emo is living on. I don't see it going away anytime soon.
Yeah, no, which is great. Like, there's a quote from Chris Leo kind of said, I'm going to paraphrase it horribly, but it's sort of like, you don't want to be, you know, remembered for that word, but then if you're not mentioned, you're also kind of miffed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's better than being called Chill Wave in 2017.
Yeah. Well, Davey from the Promise Ring, he was with Maritime at the time, and he played the Bell House. And this young kid, he was like, I don't think he was 18. He was got to be, I don't know, must have been all ages show. I don't know how he got in. He was screaming Red and Blue Jeans during a Maritime show, different band. Yes, Dan is back there, but in the drums, but not the same band. And you see Davey kind of giggle, but the kid's relentless. I never told you this story.
You told me this on the last podcast. Oh, but I'm enjoying it the second
but
time.
But it's worth, but the kid, it's worth saying again with this context, because first thing I said to Davey after, dude, how lame was that? And he goes, no. He kind of like stopped me, which was cool. He was like, no, that was awesome. The kid showed up. He paid a ticket to go see Maritime. I'm not going to play Red and Blue Jeans, but I'm glad he showed up. How great. What a positive outlook versus heckling him or like saying something mean. Like, the kid wanted to hear Promise Ring. He knew that those two members were there. He still showed up.
Yeah.
And that goes back to, I hope that that happens for those other bands.
Absolutely.
Hope that, I want to, you know, if, you know, I did do a tour with Patrick Stump when Fall Out Boy was not around, and he opened up for a band. What band was that? It was an EVR band, and could not get arrested. He had a solo record, could not get arrested. And, you know, I felt bad.
Was this pre-Fall Out Boy or when he did the R&B?
This was in between. This was the R&B.
Soul Punk. The album's called Soul Punk.
Yeah.
Yeah, that album didn't really do anything.
So, but where were all those fans before? Like, I'm
just...
Yeah, yeah. And maybe that takes time, and it wasn't the right timing, all that stuff happens. But I was like, wait a minute, I thought that band was huge. Where is all the... So I hope that happens. I want that to happen. And I think it will. I think when we didn't bring up Panic at the disco, they've morphed. And now they have a whole new fan base that didn't even know the first iteration of the band. And how great is that? You've morphed and gotten a new fan base. Like, that's all you want as an artist.
Oh, absolutely.
So for them to continue is also a feat and still continue.
Yeah, I saw them sell out Madison Square Garden earlier this year. And
insane.
What just warms my heart is that it is not a nostalgia thing at all. It's not a bunch of people my age. They're just like standing still and sipping beers and like, oh, high school. This is like high school. It wasn't that at all.
No.
It was all these young kids who were maybe at one of their first arena shows losing their shit. And Panic was not just, you know, mooching off of the old stuff. The kids were going crazy for like all the deep cuts on Death of a Bachelor, the new album. They only played I Write Sins. They played that in its entirety, and they did like a medley mashup of 5 of the songs from the first
album.
So
smart.
That's all they did. That's all they did of the first album. And still, they got away with it, and people loved the show. Headlining show at MSG.
So that's like, they're able to morph. Like, that's special. That's something that they're able to do with their fan base, and they've able to bring a new audience. I hope the other bands from that
era.
It's
so hard.
It's hard, but I hope they see that and say, that's a model. Maybe try that. You need new fans. And then hopefully maybe they do go back and hear that first record. You hope.
Oh, I think they absolutely do. I do think Fever You Can Sweat Out is viewed as like some sort of pop punk classic.
Yeah.
Amongst, you know, a lot of kids who
for
are,
sure.
You know, if you're like 18 and into alt music, then yeah, it's like that sort of, you know, dookie Enema of the State status.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to talk to the dudes in that band about that. Like, changing and why you made those decisions, and what about that first record still resonates? How does that, like, your new fan base, the old fan base, how do you, like, that's a probably really interesting conversation.
I've talked to Brendan about that. It's interesting because the first half of the album is purposefully kind of a pop punk album. It's still like dressed up a little bit, but the first half is a pop punk album, and then the second half that has I Write Sins and Others on it is more kind of like the vaudeville thing with all the strings and fancy
yeah.
stuff. Because they made like the first half of the album, and then even like in the middle of the session, they were just kind of like getting tired of that sound, and it had been around and it had been big for the while, and, like, you know, everyone compared them to Fall Out Boy.
Yeah.
So in the middle of making their first album, they were already thinking about, like, what's next?
What's next? Which is smart. That's how you stay a band.
Because there are some bands from the scene who just sort of are good, and bands I respect a lot who still are around and doing well for themselves, but kind of just make the same albums over and over again.
And you got to know your audience, know who's coming, know what, you know, morph, understand. I think those are important things that you're right, some bands are better at.
Sure.
And especially with this genre morphing and all the different attributes that it's maybe pulling from, it's worth doing that self-evaluation.
Yeah, a little fan survey every once in a while.
Just send out the Google survey. Like, do you want breakdowns? Yes or no?
Well, for on the Panic at the Disco note, go listen to, or it's not, go search on YouTube. It's not recorded, but search for Panic at the Disco Positive Hardcore. You will like what you find.
Nice reference, Chris. They did a cover, right?
It's not a cover. It's just this joke song they do towards the end of sets. Usually it's only if a lot of fans in the front are yelling for it, but they actually play like a standard like hardcore song, like double bass,
yeah,
really
yeah, yeah.
fast, choppy guitars, and Brendan can legit scream like really well. I mean, he's just so all around like talented. Like,
yeah, yeah,
it's
yeah.
like, of course you can scream like a really good hardcore yeah. frontman.
Oh, that's good. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
All right, I'll yell that next
time. Get into the front row of a Panic show and yell positive hardcore.
Done.
So let's keep it in the present and talk about our favorite albums this year, things that came out of this scene of music. What if you were suggesting someone some new records that came out in 2017, what would you put their way?
The new Prawn record, Run, really like. I would say, what was the other? Sorority Noise, without a doubt. It came out in February.
Yep.
But that, I called it. I told Fred and everybody in that label. I said, I was the first person to call this album of the year. I think it still might be. I think that's an awesome, awesome record.
You're not as blank as you think.
Yes, you're not as blank as you think you are. Great record. And then who I just saw last night, Alex Leahy, the girl from Australia. She has a record called Love You Like a Brother? Like You Like Your Brother? Something Like a Brother. I'm looking at the album cover in my head. Awesome. Like, it's basically a chorus on a chorus. Like, pop hits. I've sent it to a few other bands to check out, and everyone's kind of been cool. So that's one I've been telling people
about. I haven't heard that. It's what, like, just... like really coarse, hooky, heavy song.
Yeah, it's hooky. Like the verses are hooky. Yeah. The opening's hooky.
I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
What's a good song? We can drop in a little bit of it here. What's a good song?
Every Day is a Weekend. My hands are cold, but my feet are not. Are you leaving me, or have you just forgot? Because in the end, we were never friends, but more. Whoa, 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 whoa. You've got things like a family. They're a bigger deal than I'll ever be. You know, that's okay. We should ride this wave to shore. Whoa, 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 whoa. Plenty of stuff to check out. Plenty of stuff to just get into this. If you're someone who's scratching your head about all this stuff that we're talking about here. As my girlfriend says, you're the king of a kingdom I've never heard of. And I don't know about the king part either. But it's nice to be, it's nice to help.
You're at least in the court.
I'm in the court. all I want to do is help. Like, these bands deserve people to hear about them, and I hope that either it's the podcast or the website or a tweet or, you know, a mess, you know, an Instagram thing. Just like this podcast, you hope that someone else that might be into something similar listens to it. And that's, it's so hard now. There's so much noise. And I think to have people that people can listen to and like your podcast or listen, watch, you know, on you on Twitter, if you talk about a band, people are going to listen and you hope that you help them get to another place.
That's what it's about.
Yeah. That's all I care about. I remember in college, I worked at the radio station and I was able, I had all the records. So I would make mixtapes and pick up friends and drive to shows and play them all the new stuff on the way to the show. And that was like a fun, that was what you did. And then
it's like this little window where I have you, like, let me play you some stuff.
Yeah. And it wasn't like they could have heard it anywhere else.
Yeah.
That's how I first heard Newfound. I remember, this is kind of weird in college, but I actually had high school kids that listened to my college radio show. I actually picked them up. I don't know why their parents let me do that. But I picked them up and I played them the first Newfound Glory record. Because you know the only reason I bought it? Because I was like, the record store guy was like, he used to be in Shai Hulud. And I was like, done.
Yeah.
Sign me up. Not knowing what it sounded like.
Yeah.
That leap of faith. I miss that. The leap of faith part of like you holding something.
Yeah.
You don't even know what they look like back then. I know that sounds crazy. There wasn't a wiki. There wasn't Google search images. Like you just, you saw the cover, you saw the label, and you had a leap of faith of trust. Sometimes it didn't work out, but a lot of times it did.
And it's something that we'll generally just never have again. It really is a bygone thing.
Yeah. Like I miss that. Like picking up a record and just being like, I don't know what this sounds like, but I know the label. Someone told me it's cool. I'm going to put it on. I think, too, the missing part of that physical visual part, like you asking me about records, what did I visualize? My iTunes?
Yeah, exactly.
And my Spotify. Yeah. And that's just zeros and ones. But if you ask me, you know, what record were you playing in 1994? Like I could
absolutely
visualize,
like the album art, all that stuff.
And I know the 12th track as much as the first track. And I sometimes wish that I did that more with music, but it's almost like too much. Maybe because I'm working. Maybe I'm not a kid and I don't. But I still feel like I listen to work. I listen to music all day at work. That's work related. So, but I miss that.
Getting that Days Away album in its rightful place back on streaming services.
But isn't that nuts that there's an album for
put
that?
Put out by Fueled by Ramen.
That wasn't on streaming services. There's still stuff out there. Like I would tell people and fans, like if you have records and you remember that it's not up there, go tell the label. They probably don't remember.
Yo, one album that I got into from your Washed Up Emo playlist, and I feel like you probably have a connection with this because it was an Equal Vision album in 2002. Maybe you were working there then?
I was there in 2004, but I was still talking to them at that time.
Yeah, The Rocking Horse Winner.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had never heard of them, and I heard the song Miss You.
Yeah,
I was blown
great
away
song.
By that song. That song's fucking awesome.
Yeah, Rocking Horse Winner, I think, had a really rad moment where that was like really powerful girl singer, like band was awesome. Like, yeah, that was definitely that was a fun moment, I think, for EVR. No one paid attention.
So I'll just to sum up who is in the book, I'll run through the names here. So it's Dan Didier and Davey Von Bolen of Promise Ring, Maritime in Vermont. I'm not gonna go through every band for every person. There's
you don't have to.
I'm looking at this Mike Kinsella.
I know
a few
it's so
lines
ridiculous.
Down. Norman Brannan, Texas Is the Reason, Chris Caraba, you already know, Mike Kinsella, American Football, Captain Jazz, Owen, many bands, Chris Leo, the Van Pelts. Rainer Maria, Matt Pryor, the Get Up Kids, Eric Richter, Christy Front Drive, Blair Sheehan, Knapsack, Jealous Sound, who we were talking about a lot, and Chris Simpson from Mineral.
Not bad, right?
Yeah. Nice little trip around the horn for the first time.
Yeah, and I think Volume 2 will kind of take the same shape where new bands, like new revival bands from, and bands from the 2000s and bands from the 80s, 90s. So try to have everybody on one for volume two.
Awesome.
There's plenty left.
Anything else you wanted to touch on?
No. Hopefully people dig it. And complaints, washedupemo.com. Go for it. I love complaints, comments, suggestions. The most amazing thing is the unsolicited emails that I get from around the world. Either a band from Australia that sends me a record, or a kid in Brazil that wants to know, he just got into Screamo from 98 and wants to know another band, and I help him, or they tip me off to something. Like, that back and forth, like, I love the, when you and I text or tweet back and forth, I love that stuff. So I encourage that, and I hope that this leads to more conversations about the scene and more people find out about more bands, because it's harder than ever to kind of come above the noise. So hopefully there's a community around this to hopefully cultivate that.
Yeah, shout out the exact social handles.
So everything is just at Washed Up Emo. So Twitter is Washed Up Emo, Facebook is Washed Up Emo, Tumblr, Instagram / Washed Up Emo. If you want to come to the DJ night in New York City, it's, the Facebook is Emo Night NYC.
There it is.
For 6 years, my friends. We didn't touch on that, but we don't have to.
let's not.
We're not.
Yo, thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, that is it. That is the interview. Thanks so much to Tom for coming by. Check out the book. As we said, it's out already. It's out there in the world. Go buy it. Anthology of Emo, Volume 1. And like we were saying, most likely more volumes to come. Tom does lots and lots of podcast interviews, and you should subscribe to his podcast, because I can say that you should not wait for all of his podcasts to be transcribed in a book. You should listen to them now. Subscribe to the Washed Up Emo podcast, which is also, aside from a podcast and a book, also a DJ night, a Twitter, a blog, and a second website called isthisbandemo.com, where you can literally type in a band or an artist and Tom tells you whether or not they are emo. Isn't that convenient? So, thanks to Tom for coming by. This was our last episode of the year. I'm kind of sad, but we'll be back next January with more artist interviews, more interesting people interviews, more fun. So subscribe to the show, search for hashtag AlternaFacts, all one word, either in the podcast app of your phone, in iTunes, whatever. Drop us a star rating, it's super helpful. And also just any feedback you have for me about the show, about what you like, what you don't like. Specific, however specific, however negative, positive you want to get, it's all super helpful. And also just Twitter is useful for that too, if you want to just go into detail about the show. My handle is at CPayne on a plane, or you can just search for my name. It's CHRISPAYNE. I'm always just dropping little hints in there about what's coming up on the show. So, good way to stay in touch. And I think that's just about all I have for you guys. So, hope you enjoyed the show. Hope you learned about emo. I know I did. I'm always learning. And thanks so much for Tom and all our guests this year for coming by. And we'll